something happening here. But what it is ain't exactly clear.
I'm Kate Magruder with Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land, Oral Histories of Mendocino County. Today we'll be hearing from Nancy Peregrine, an herbalist and healthcare practitioner who carved out a spot of wilderness for her homestead in Whale Gulch. The epitome of a can-do woman, she built her home by hand, without power tools. Before that, at age 18, she'd hitchhiked around the world, and at 19, rode a horse down the west coast of Mexico, alone and pregnant, before making her way here in 1967.
I moved here in 67, not knowing that there was going to be a Back to the Land movement. I thought I was moving to a wilderness area, and it was just me. And so when I ended up buying this piece of land, before I knew it, people around me were buying pieces of land too. And then I realized, oh my goodness, it's a movement.
Can you tell me when you were born and where you grew up? Let's just start there. I just want to find out. I want to find out what shaped you, Nancy Peregrine.
Well, let's see. I was born in Berkeley in 45, right after World War II. And my father worked for Shell Development Company, and he was a brilliant, brilliant biochemist. He figured out the molecular structure of penicillin in World War II so that they could mass produce it. And unfortunately, he developed cancer and died at 33 when I was not quite 4. Anyway, that changed our lives quite a bit. Yeah, my mom, she was a school teacher. She became a school teacher in Alameda, but she was still struggling with the loss of my dad. And she took her life when I was 12, and she did that in Pasadena, where her mother lived, who was in her 80s. And so my grandmother adopted me when she was 82 and I was 12. So you can imagine what a pair we were. She was born in 1876. So she was very liberal politically, and in terms of the morals of the time, she was still back in the 1800s, and here I was in the 60s, a teenager. So we were quite an interesting pair. Before she died, when she was in her 90s, she decided to give me a little chunk of money, and she gave me $10,000, and I knew that I had to put it into land. And I think that was from my Irish ancestry, that I just knew that if I had land, I could support myself forever. It didn't matter. And the kids, I could grow food. And then at Antioch College, we had a friend, Peter Adair, who was in film. And he said, oh, my folks have bought some land in Northern California, and they would like anybody who's interested to help them build their house, and they'll give them a place to camp and money for their food to get by. And so we came out, and some friends did as well. And when we were out here, we learned that. That was in 67, the winter, fall of 67. That was just here in Whale Gulch. And Whale Gulch, for people that don't know, is the very northern western corner of Mendocino County. So we're quite distant from the county seat. And this is somewhat of a remote place. It had been logged. It's steep. It had giant old growth firs, not so much redwood, some redwood, but mostly old fir. And it was logged by somebody back in the day without owning it and cutting the trees down. And you can still find a lot of trees they never got out. We met Bob McKee, who's quite the character up here. He had grown up here, and he inherited a farm that had been his great-grandfather's, I believe, and he had bought Whale Gulch for $50 an acre. He had subdivided it. So when I bought this piece, which was 20 acres, I don't know what I was thinking, that I was going to be living forever in a wilderness area, because obviously he was going to sell the other pieces. And so that's how the community came to be. It was all thanks to Bob McKee. But I have to say, Bob, he sold land to a lot of single women with children, and if they were on welfare, he always made the payment so that they could do it on their welfare check, and that's how a lot of women got their land. I was fortunate to have that little pre-death inheritance from my grandmother, so my land was 20 acres. He said at 500 an acre, that would be $10,000, but if I paid cash, it would be 8,500, and I thought, oh, great, then I have 1,500 to build the house. So that's how it all came down. Anyway, Bob McKee was quite instrumental in populating this area, sometimes to the chagrin of the people in town. I have to say, all these new people coming who were very colorful were sometimes hard for people in town to accept. But there were the people that even bent over backwards to accept people, and they were wonderful. There was Mamie's little grill, and Mamie ran the grill, but she also helped out people that were moving up here that had any needs. And there were quite a few people, but sometimes it was hard. My husband had a goatee. It was like a well-kept beard. They threw him out of one of the local restaurants for having a beard, along with another guy that had a beard. And that's how it was back in those days. You just never knew how you would be received. And I think it's really interesting for some of those people who are still around today, and myself. I mean, they come to see me for health issues and whatnot. You know, it's like we've all become one. A lot of our kids have married their kids and that kind of thing. So there's been quite a mixture of our two communities.
When you first came, how did you create your shelter? What did you do? Where did you begin in the middle of this wilderness?
Well, when we arrived here, we didn't have a road to the land. We parked over in the meadow. We lived there with my now 2-year-old daughter. And then I was pregnant with my second daughter. And my husband contracted hepatitis A and was basically bedbound. And to hang out in a little potato chip truck converted to a house for a winter was just unfathomable to me. So I would come over here, walk over with an axe, and I cleared this land with an axe. And people have a hard time believing that. But I have to say, it wasn't big old trees. And then we devised a plan. Now, you know, technically you're supposed to get a building permit and you're supposed to get your septic system first, but whoever heard of somebody living in a septic tank? You start with an outhouse and then you build something and then you're an outlaw, basically. So we made a little cabin. It was 16 by 16. And I taught myself carpentry with no generator. You know, it was only a handsaw. Everything was hand. I had the Brayson bit to drill holes and everything hand. Some of those tools from the old junk man in town because people didn't have all the power tools they have now. Now everybody uses generators, but back then it was just everything by hand. So it took so long to build this house. I just had to stay focused to get it done. You know, I'm my own plumber, my own... everything. I do hire somebody for electric because I don't feel so confident with something you can't see. I like plumbing because you can see the water flow. And carpenter, I started building my kitchen. My kitchen was just a bunch of crates when we first moved in, and the only cook stove was wood, just a wood stove with a wood oven. And my husband left, and I thought he was gone for good. He had another girlfriend somewhere. And so I thought, okay, I'm just going to build my cabinets. Well, I built the cabinets I have, and they have some good stories, too. I got the plywood for my drawers from a guy had moved in down the road who built an acid factory, and he was into dosing people, including kids. And the community, not that we were that many at the time, but we rose up and we said, no, this isn't appropriate, and we drove him out. Well, so I knew that there was this plywood back there, and it was a winter when nobody was around, and I took the four-wheel drive truck back to disassemble the acid factory to get the plywood, and the plywood had these big purple stains on it. I knew that was the acid that had spilled, you know, and I've told people, if you wanted to get high in acid, you could lick my drawers. Yeah. So back in those days, we didn't have any phones. And when we were fishing out of Noyo, a young boy had given me some pigeons that had come into his pigeon loft because he had too many. Some wild ones had followed his own back in. He would release them, and then they have these little one-way doors, and his would come back in, and the wild ones would come in with them. So he gave me a bunch of his pigeons, which I just had for fun, really. But I had chickens and a chicken coop. Well, I found that you could still buy little capsules to put on the pigeons' legs. And when people would be here and then they were going towards Whitethorn where the first phone was, I'd say, could you make a phone call for me? And then write the answer to whatever it is I'm trying to find out on this little piece of paper and put it in this and let the pigeon go. And they would come back to the to the chicken coop. Sometimes they didn't make it that night, and I guess they stopped somewhere in transit, and then the next morning they would come in. And yeah, so that's how I first did communications. Then I got more high tech and I became a ham radio operator. But I also, for 10 years, did wilderness trips with groups that would come up mainly from the Bay Area with my 6-pack llamas and took them out into the King Range and down into the Sinkyon Wilderness State Park for 3 or 4 days. So I had 6 pack llamas and groups of up to 12 people with me, and usually I'd take a helper too, because actually I cooked all the meals and it was a lot of work, really. So somebody would get to come for free in exchange for helping me out. I love sharing this land with all the animals that live here. There's some of them right out there. Elk from the Sinkyon, which had been native to here, then they had all been killed off, and there were still the elk up at Prairie Creek. Well, some years ago, they brought back a bunch of the Prairie Creek ones to the BLM land, Hidden Valley, and put them in an enclosure with very high fences. And then eventually, after the females had babies, they took down the fences and let them go. Well, they migrated down to the Sinkyon Wilderness State Park, which is just down the road here. But nowadays, elk migrate up here, and they like to hang out here at my place. So I live with elk fairly regularly. There was one I called Ferdinand because he wasn't with any others. He was just on his own. And he moved in with my llamas in the barn. There were the 6 llamas and an elk all living together in the barn. And the way I found out was I went down to feed the llamas one morning and I heard this huge clattering in the barn. Well, there's some cables holding the barn square. And he had jumped up and his antlers had caught in the cables. And so he was battering the cables. Anyway, he ended up just living here and he would eat and then lie down and chew his cud. And my dogs and myself and all my friends, we just considered him part of who lived here. We didn't get too close, probably not closer than like 5 feet, because he could just turn his head and get you without meaning to.
When your children were beginning to get to be school age, what did you do about school for them?
So the first thing we did was we hired a woman through the San Francisco Chronicle to be our teacher. And we had an empty little cabin and we had fur rounds for the desks and fur rounds for the stools and kerosene lamps because it was a dark little cottage. And I have to say that those kids that had those circumstances, 2 of them became doctors, 1 became an engineer, 1 became an environmental lawyer. They were they're the most amazing kids, and yet they didn't have a lot of money spent on them, but what they did have was parental interest, and I think that's the most important thing, that their parents were so involved with their education. Then we decided to put up our own school, and we bought a canvas yurt for the first school, and we waterproofed it and this and that. Well, it didn't work out that well. So then we decided, okay, we have to build a wooden school. So that's what we did. We ended up building part of it and then another part later. And now we have K through 12, and we are part of the Leggett Unified School District.
What's the name of that school?
It's Whale Gulch School. Yeah, and I taught at it for many years. I taught Spanish primarily.
If you were going to look back over this arc of time, this 50 years that you've been doing this here, is there a time that you just thought that you remember feeling most alive, most fulfilled?
So I have to say that back in 73, there was a huge fire that started in Edersburg and went all the way to Shelter Cove. It was called the Finley Creek Fire, and it burned the northern side of Whale Gulch. And the law enforcement came to tell us all to evacuate, and we were told that there was going to be a backfire set at Four Corners. And that was the moment when I rose up and said, no, you're not. And that was the beginning of my being involved with fire. Now, I never knew I was going to be involved with fire, but because nobody else was doing it, I went into the phone, called CAL FIRE, and said, there cannot be a backfire at Four Corners because there's a whole community between Four Corners and the top of the ridge. You can't see it from the road on the whole, but there's probably 50 houses in this area. And so they didn't. But that started me off on being the fire person, and I've been ever since. I mean, as young people grew up and wanted to become a fire chief, I back off gladly, and I'll just be an assistant and the desk person and whatnot. But I have done all the trainings and have been the first on scene for many things, and the medical things, I've done it all. I mean, we've had SIDS babies, we've had over the bank deaths and all that stuff. And, you know, nobody else was really that involved back then. But I have to say, a lot of the younger people have risen up and wanted to get involved. And that was one of the things I loved about working at the school, was if you could get kids into community service, it was great because they would stay with it. They would see that it made them feel good about themselves. And so a lot of the kids here have grown up and become first responders, done fire training, and gotten into the community service. So we're lucky that our fire department has 21 people on it right now. And it's a small community, but that's because of all the young people, pretty much mostly young. A few are more my age. I'm 73 now. Putting my energy into things that can benefit the community, I love doing that. And maybe it's my way of making a family. I feel like with my two kids, that's, I sort of made my own family because I had lost mine so young.
If you're just joining us, this is Kate Magruder with Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land Oral Histories of Mendocino County. Let's get back to our interview with Nancy Peregrine. As you look back, was there a downside to the choice that you made to be here?
Well, you know, a lot of us started growing cannabis back in the day. I mean, we were, I think, the originals, the first ones that knew what Cienzamillo was. And now we're a bunch of old grannies, and people don't realize that all these young people are taking over everything. They think, oh, they're so hot, but actually we're the originals. Anyway, we were very clandestine. We hid everything very well, but this was one of the favorite places for camp to practice on. And so there were some heavy times. I mean, the helicopters broke down the tops of my orchard's fruit trees. That's how low they were. And often families didn't even sleep in their homes. They'd sleep out somewhere so that they could run if the helicopters came and that kind of thing. They terrorized us, you know. And what we're talking about is small patches. I mean, maybe a dozen plants spread out a big area and in bushes and things like that. So yeah, that was a heavy time. So I'm glad that we don't have that now. But oh boy, it certainly is a big conundrum how to make it all work out. Yeah. Well, because we're so far from law enforcement, sometimes there would be crazy stuff happen that law needed to be involved in, and we have to wait for law enforcement to come from Willits. So that's a couple hours. Yeah. There have been a few people who have died, who, you know, murder and things like that. Not that much, thankfully, but some. So that's been hard. You know, we chose to live that far out so that we'd have to police ourselves, basically. And on the whole, that's how it is. But sometimes people get crazy for whatever reason and things go awry.
In terms of the politics and the environmental awareness and the activism that not only happened here with you, it sounds like in the early 70s, but happened all over the county, do you see that as an outgrowth of the people who came?
I do, definitely. Yeah, I do see a lot of the activism was from these people that moved back to the land. And if you were to say that, did we have a general spirituality or religion, it would be preservation of nature, protecting nature, I would say. But how did we all end up with that belief and that deep feeling? It's more than just, you know, something like going to church. It's like a deep feeling to protect the land. And we've done so much trying to preserve the salmon, not that our homesteads maybe don't cause some of the damage. I know roads can. A lot of the roads were actually just using old logging roads, but of course those weren't year-round, and now our own roads are year-round. But we started many groups, Matole Restoration Council, the Salmon Group, Sanctuary Forest, and many other groups, and EPIC, Environmental Protection Information Center. All these groups, a lot of their makeup is back to the land people. Our community seemed to have, without even talking about it, an understanding of preserving the environment back then. And one of my neighbors who moved here a few years after me, Richard Ginger, who you might know of, it became his life work to keep an eye on Georgia Pacific down the USAW Road, because this was a huge area of redwoods and fir that had nobody scrutinizing it, and they were just taking everything and leaving huge messes. And Richard would report back to us what was going on. I saw some of it because my husband and I got into fishing in Noyo down in Fort Bragg, the harbor at Fort Bragg. And so the closest way down there is to go down this dirt road, 26 mile of dirt road. So I would see it if they left messes close to the road. But at that time, CDF, California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection, which is now called CAL FIRE, but CDF approved timber harvest plans, and they didn't have any provision for if you log 360 degrees around a piece, should you leave that piece in the center to be the seed to regenerate that area? And at that same time, we started an Environmental Protection Information Center called EPIC. So people were at work that were of a mind bent to be more into the laws, looking at the fact that there was no law to protect pieces that were the last remnants. And so people were working on that. And at the same time, Richard was reporting what was going on down Usaw Road. So it came a time that there was one piece left, like a piece of a pie, surrounded by clear cuts and very steep land, Little Sally Bell Grove, we call it. And at that time, too, it became necessary for people submitting timber harvest plans to do an archaeological study to see if these places had been occupied by previous peoples. Interestingly, the one in this grove, they said yes, but it was pre-Sinkione, and therefore it wasn't worth preserving because it was so old. I always thought they had it backwards because you'd think that the older it is, the more it should be preserved. Anyway, the community here, Well Gulch, mobilized, and we went down and occupied the grove, and the loggers were coming up from Fort Bragg in the dark, like at 4:30 or 5 in the morning, and we were in the grove. And the first time this happened, everybody was shocked that there were people in the grove where they had never seen anybody before. And so we ended up doing a circle in what we called the archaeological site, and nothing really happened that time. But when the lawsuit for the had been submitted for looking at should remnant pieces be preserved, it was submitted in Santa Rosa because it's not a logging community, and Georgia Pacific had it moved up to Ukiah. Well, there had been a stay on logging until it would be heard, and our lawyers said the stay went with it to Ukiah, and their lawyers said no, it didn't. And so we knew that they would come back in and try to get all the trees on the ground before it could be heard. And so we went back, and that time the law enforcement from Fort Bragg area, they were there with all their buses to take us back, and all the people that had been deputized. There were quite a few. I mean, I could say maybe 100 people or more, and some politicians from down south. So they were telling people that were in the grove, if you leave and go out onto the road, that's neutral ground, but if you stay here, you're going to be arrested. Well, three women were arrested pretty early on. So myself and two friends had gone back out onto the road to discuss the situation, and we decided we wanted to go back in to act in solidarity with the three. So we went back in, but it was a matter of pride for us in a way to get back to the archaeological site, which was a ways into this, and there's cop cars going back and forth. And so for us women that had been living in the woods for years, it was like a point to make that we could evade all of their cars and get back to the archaeological site. And then we just came out in the middle of the road holding hands walking towards them. And they, of course, their jaws dropped and they rushed us and threw us on the ground and handcuffed us. And off we went to the Ukiah jail. So in jail, we had phones, which we did not have here. It was a half an hour to the Whitethorn payphone. So in a way, it made it easier to get the word out. So that was our little part, because I have to say, the whole community, the greater community, mobilized at that time. And even the movie theater marquee said, go to Sinkione now. So it became a big thing. So our little part was to write releases for all the newspapers. That's when the Mendocino grapevine was happening way back in the day. So we wrote things and we'd call the newspapers and say, would you like a statement from the Sinkione Six? And they would, of course, say yes, because we didn't have money for the phone fees, but they accepted the charges. And then we'd tell them what was going on, because you know how going to jail always makes the news, whereas if you don't go to jail, you're not as newsworthy. So that was sort of our point. And I have to say that the other women in the jail who were there for probably minor things like bad checks or things, they were so gracious to us, because they could have been not. But they said, would you like some tea? And they had tea bags, and then they just get hot water from the sink there. And they said, you're supposed to have a mattress and a pencil and paper. And you should have access to all these things because the matron, she actually had a really bad attitude towards us and she didn't want to give us anything. She wanted us to sleep on the bare cement floor. And I have to say that one of the police officers who was doing our thumbprints as we came in, he told my friend Marie, who has the store, The Hemp Connection, in town now, and who's older than me, actually, he told her, I really support what you're doing. You know, and a lot of people said that even though, you know, they were in the role of the opposite. Then, yeah, we did a little time in jail, and then we were seen by a judge, and he said, okay, your punishment is to write 10 letters to whomever you want explaining why you did what you did. And his secretary, too, said she supported what we were doing. So, you know, everybody was supporting us in sort of a roundabout way. Anyway, I have to say the end result was that the little Sally Bell Grove still stands. Yeah, so anyway.
So is there anything else you'd want to say, Nancy? You've given us so much.
Well, we weren't the first people to live on this land, you know. And my daughter found an arrowhead in our road cut, actually, a beautiful obsidian arrowhead. And so there are still the original people's descendants living in this area. And they didn't go to a reservation. They're Wailaki, Tsingkiyun, or Tsingkiyuni. So I would just like to acknowledge them and that this was their land. Not that they owned land, they believed in the land was everybody's. And so we came in with our Western belief that you own your land and, you know, you have boundaries around it and whatnot. And I've met some of the people and that are descendants. So I just want to acknowledge them because they were here and they are here sort of scattered around still. And sometimes they've married the people that came in later. And so now that part has also started mixing. And so we just have a pretty good mix. I just think there's not enough of other cultures here. Sometimes it seems very Caucasian and middle class sometimes, even though some of us have lived without much money for some years, but I'd still say middle class because we weren't coming from deep poverty where we just couldn't see our way out. You know, we've always had some resources that we could turn to, and so we've been really fortunate, I think. I'm grateful to have found this place and have been able to spend my life here. And so I don't know how it's all going to end. I would love to just die in my bed if I could, but if I start to not be able to do my firewood and whatnot, then I'm not sure how I'll manage. I might take in a boarder, somebody to help me. I think of different things, and we all do at this age. You know, we're all getting up in age, and quite a few people are selling their land and moving to towns, and I think, should I be doing that too, or can I hang out here longer? I would like to stay here until the end, so we'll see. I just don't know.
We've been listening to Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land, Oral Histories of Mendocino County. I'm Kate Magruder. We just heard from Nancy Peregrine. You can catch short excerpts during the news hour on Thursdays and longer episodes at 3:30 on Thursday afternoons. They're also on our website and Facebook page with pictures and longer versions. Promise of Paradise is supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities, California Humanities, the Arts Council of Mendocino County, the Judy Pruden Historical Preservation Fund of the Community Foundation of Mendocino County, the Mendocino Institute, and Grace Hudson Museum.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear.